All right, in our study of Deuteronomy, we've come to chapter 21. The chapter naturally breaks up into five sections, which is more sections than usual. It's not as that long in terms of the number of verses, but a number of topics, although they're related to each other. So first I'll read Deuteronomy chapter 21. If anyone is found slain, lying in the field in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess, and it is not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance from the slain man to the surrounding cities. It shall be that the elders of the city nearest to the slain man will take a heifer which has not been worked and which has not pulled with a yoke. The elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with flowing water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. By their word every controversy and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of that city nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. Then they shall answer and say, "Our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. Provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed. Do not lay innocent blood to the charge of your people Israel. And atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the blood. So you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you, when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and desire her, and would take her for your wife, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, and mourn her father and her mother a full month. After that you may go in to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. And it shall be, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free. But you certainly shall not sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally, because you have humbled her. If a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, and they have borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, and if the firstborn son is of her who is unloved, then it shall be on the day he bequeaths his possessions to his sons that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife, in preference to the son of the unloved, the true firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city and to the gate of the city. And they shall say to the elders of this city, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. You shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. If a man has committed a sin deserving of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day, so that you do not defile the land which the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. For he who is hanged is accursed of God. Now, the previous two chapters of Deuteronomy have both dealt with this question of the application of the sixth commandment, you shall not kill. And in rather interesting, perhaps surprising ways, so chapter 19 had to do with the case of the provision of a city of refuge. The one who killed a person accidentally had a place to flee, to be delivered from the avenger of blood. And in chapter 20, we saw last week provisions for warfare and how warfare should be conducted. But in both cases, we saw the emphasis on the fact that God values life. Neither killing someone accidentally nor killing someone in warfare is a violation of the sixth commandment. They're not murder in the strict sense. And yet we saw both chapters provide a regulation that underlines the fact that because men are made in God's image, the shedding of blood is a very serious thing. Chapter 21 continues that same theme. One of the advantages of going through Deuteronomy chapter by chapter, as opposed to just jumping in chapter 21, is to give some background, what I've just sketched out, to help understand the point of at least the first section, and I think it's helpful for the other sections as well. So what I want to do is look at the five sections. Okay, so that's sort of a tall order. I'm going to spend more time on the first section than the others. That goes verses 1 through 9. But also try to emphasize the last section, verses 22 and 23, as they point forward to Christ and are quoted in the New Testament. And also tie together some of the central ideas we've been looking at. Okay, so we'll see if we can do this. Okay, so verses 1 through 9. One is tempted to call this the case of the unsolved murder. So if you think of Agatha Christie or something like that, well, okay, this was a murder that's not solved. The reference in verse 21 to someone being found slain, the word in the Hebrew means pierced or stabbed. So this is clearly not an accidental death. This is someone who was murdered. But the difficulty is that they don't know who committed the murder. And so this is a law for provision in that situation. The first thing that's done is to determine what we would call the jurisdiction, I guess. They find out which town or city is closest to the place where the person was found slain. And the rulers of that city then have a responsibility to go through an appointed ritual. It is a sort of a strange ritual. It's not really mirrored anywhere else in the scriptures. Some of the meaning of the details is unclear. I don't have a lot of time, so I'm not going to maybe talk about the things that are not so clear, but part of it is fairly clear. The washing of hands that's mentioned in verse 4, so I'll repeat some of the details. They find this location, they take a heifer that has not been worked and hasn't pulled a yoke, and they break the neck of the heifer. And then it says in verse 6 that they make a confession. So they wash their hands over the heifer. That's, I think, fairly familiar to us. Psalm 26, for example, we sing about the washing our hands in innocence. Pilate may have had something like that in mind when he washed his hands, attempted to declare his innocence with regard to Christ. So that's a ritual way of declaring their innocence, but then they make a solemn statement in verse 7, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. It's a way of underlining the fact that they've made a careful investigation into the case. So that's in the background here. They couldn't do this honestly unless they first had made every attempt to find out who had killed the deceased. But having failed to find the person after a careful investigation, in the presence of these priests, they make this solemn declaration and pray that God would not hold them guilty, would not lay the guilt of this death to their charge. So that's as briefly as I can give it, what's going on in the first 9 verses. Then what we've tried to do in Deuteronomy is always ask, what's the immediate meaning here? What would they have taken from this? And then also look at how it points forward to Christ, and I'll try to tie that in when we look at the last section. But first, what would the meaning have been? Well, the immediate meaning would have been to remind them of their duty in every case. That is, it's their responsibility to search out, to find who is the guilty party, and to execute justice. That is their responsibility as a civil magistrate, and this process underlines that. But it underlines again what we saw in chapter 19 and 20 also, which is the seriousness of the shedding of man's blood. Man is made in the image of God, and God counts the life of man as precious. Men are therefore to turn away from violence. Now, how does it emphasize that? Well, you know, in our society, if we find a person who's been killed, we think that is a serious thing. It's not just as if an animal had died. We treat it as a serious thing. But we don't go through this ritual in which we try to absolve ourselves from the guilt of that. But God gave this to them to underline that fact that we've already seen in chapters 19 and 20, that even if a person even if a city has no, you might say, immediate guilt in terms of being unable to find the murderer. Yet, the seriousness of the situation is underlined by the ritual. So, as usual, I'll ask Matthew Henry to bail me out and explain in an eloquent way what it said. He says, the purpose is that it might possess people with the dread of the guilt of blood, which defiles not only the conscience of him that sheds it, but the land in which it is shed. It cries to the magistrate for justice on the criminal, and if that cry be not heard, it cries to heaven for judgment on the land. If there must be so much care employed to save the land from guilt when the murderer was not known, it was certainly impossible to secure it from guilt if the murderer was known and yet protected. So that's, I think you can see, if you've been with us the previous chapters, you can see the underlining again of that one significant fact, that God hates the violence, he hates the shedding of blood, and this ritual is intended to underline that point. The fact that Matthew Henry refers to the land is emphasized in the passage in verse 1 of chapter 21. Anyone is found slain lying in the field in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess. And we saw in earlier weeks the reference in Numbers 35 where God says that the blood that is shed pollutes the land. That actually referred to the case of an accidental murder. Even that would pollute the land. And the idea is that it's God who dwells among them. God is holy, and the shedding of blood is an offense to God. It's a serious thing. And that's underlined again in the ritual. Since this is the end of this series of chapters and of this theme to some extent in Deuteronomy, I'd like to step back a little bit and just reflect on the serious implication it has for our own nation. I don't know if you've thought about this as we've gone through the other chapters, but it is a very sobering thing to think that the violence that's shed, the violence in our land, and in particular the violence of abortion, is seen by God as staining the land, as putting us under his wrath and curse. We are already a nation which refuses to covenant with the Lord, but that refusal is even made more serious by the denial of God's law, and in particular the shedding of blood that is such a serious thing. So I hope as we've gone through this, you'll just keep in mind again how significant it is that man is made in God's image, and how God wants us to treat each other, of course negatively, not to commit murder, but positively, as we've seen in references in the New Testament, to love our neighbor as ourselves because of what God has done for us in particular. As I said, there's also a connection with Christ here, which I think I'll wait, Lord willing. I'm sure there'll be plenty of time at the end, and we'll come back to it, and I'll make a comment about that there. Let me pause and see if you have any comments or questions. First 9 verses. When I feel pressed for time, I just talk twice as fast. So, you know, this will just keep going until you slow me down. No questions? Okay. The second section has to do with marriage to a captive. And this, in terms of the theme, is actually connected with the passage we looked at last week. Remember last week in the regulation of war, there is allowance made for them to attack a city which is not within Canaan, but on their borders. And that in that situation, they were to act differently, and they could take captives of the women and the children and of the spoil. And so in terms of the theme of Deuteronomy, this really goes back to that or to the circle of ideas we looked at last week. And the question is, what happens when you go and you take captives, and among the captives is a woman that you want to take in marriage? Okay, so that's the basic question. How is that situation to be treated? And again, there's a ritual appointed, which this makes has more connections with other parts of the ceremonial law. So, for example, the ritual of shaving her head and trimming her nails and so on is connected with some of the requirements put up on there, Leviticus 14 and Numbers 8, of cleansing from various defilements. So that part makes sense in terms of the way the law regulated certain cleansings. Then there's also an appointed month of mourning for the loss of her says specifically her father and mother. You might say her whole family connection, her whole culture, because she's been taken out of that. And that again is the appointed time for mourning. For example, at the end of Deuteronomy, when Moses dies, they mourn for a month. So it's a similar appointment, something that you'd be familiar with from other parts of the Old Testament. Now, what is going on here? That's one of the questions. Well, certainly one part of what's going on here is a measure of kindness to this captive woman. So here's a person who's just had a significant shock, and you're going to somehow say, now you're my wife. Okay, so, well, no, there's a period in which she can adjust. She can look back on what she's lost and presumably also look forward. Some of the older commentators understand in the background here is the assumption that she is converted to the faith of the Israelites. And Psalm 45:10 is often referred to here, a psalm of Solomon, but pointing forward to Christ. And the bride is told to forget her father's house. And that's probably, at least if not implicit here, that would be from other parts of God's law required. They wouldn't have been allowed to marry someone who was an idolater. Okay, that's not maybe made explicit here, but perhaps implied in the whole cleansing procedure that is given. The specific commandment, though, after this period, after you marry her, the specific commandment that I want to focus on is in verse 14. Suppose after this the husband has, as it says here, no delight in her. Now, my understanding of the passage is that the marriage has been consummated and he wants to put her away. So in other words, he wants to divorce her. So let me step back from a second and make a couple of comments about that, and it's actually tied in with the next section as well. The language here is not completely clear, so it's not all commentators understand this as being a provision regulating divorce, although it seems to be. And I'll make some comments about the language that's what's pointed to here. The next section seems to have in view the situation of polygamy, where a man had two wives at the same time. It's possible that he had one wife and she died, and then he married again. But let me just make a comment about both of those. First of all, both of those are violations of God's moral law. Okay, Genesis 2. Rules out both divorce and polygamy. And Christ in the New Testament makes it quite clear, especially in the case of divorce. But polygamy also is ruled out clearly by God's law. So when you see something like this in the Old Testament, you have to realize that God is, a helpful word is regulating a practice which he does not approve. This will become clear when we get to Deuteronomy 24, which is sort of the classic Old Testament passage on divorce. It doesn't command the person to divorce. It says, if you go through the divorce, here's what has to happen. So I'd rather not maybe go through that discussion now, but to forestall a little bit of that, I just say here that I understand this passage as essentially saying, if you divorce the person, here's what you have to do, and not approving of the divorce or asserting it as being a valid practice in terms of God's law. Okay, so we could discuss that. Again, it's going to come up, Lord willing, in Deuteronomy 24, whether that will be 3 weeks from now, we'll see. But let me just go forward with that and see what it says in verse 14. So it says, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free. And that's that same setting her free is used actually in the next chapter in Deuteronomy of divorce. So it seems that it could be understood as, and you are setting her free in the sense of divorcing her. But the regulation is given, you shall certainly not sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally because you have humbled her. And the verb to humble is used again elsewhere in terms of the consummation of the marriage. So that seems to be implying that it was a marriage which this man wants to cease. Okay. Now, think of the situation of this woman. Her city has been besieged. She's been taken captive. Now she's been told by a man that he loves her and wants her to become an Israelite. And suddenly he doesn't want her anymore. How is she to be treated? from her point of view, she's in a very vulnerable situation. Right? The man can say, you were a captive before I married you, and I'll make you a captive after I marry you. I'll just sell you to someone else. I'm tired of you. She's in a very delicate situation, but God's law says you shall not sell her for money, first of all, and second of all, you shall not treat her brutally. So in the positive sense, she is to be cared for, she is to be provided for, she's to be treated with dignity, and in the negative sense, she's not to be abused. So the Hebrew word that's used there is translated in various ways. The New King James says, not treat her brutally. But in each case, the significance, I think, is fairly clear in terms of what's behind the translation, and that is the sense of abuse of the woman, which she would have been very subject to. She would have been in a very vulnerable situation. Now, in terms of our own understanding, I don't think most of us know situations like this. Okay, so you could ask, how is this relevant to our case? Well, we've made this point before in Deuteronomy, that Deuteronomy sets forth certain cases from which we're supposed to learn. That was often the way the Hebrews worked in teaching. They would give a particular example, often an extreme example, and you were supposed to learn from that situation how to act in other situations. So in particular, here the application would be if the man who had that degree of ownership, in the sense that he had been the master, if that person had no authority to sell the person into slavery or to abuse the wife, how much less would that be the case in a normal situation? How much more then should a husband treat his wife with kindness? And how wicked is the abuse of the woman who often is in a vulnerable situation, not exactly the way this woman is, but in others. So it is a limitation on the authority and rights of the husband that God's law provides. Just as the civil magistrate has limitations on his authority, so it is a limitation here. But it's in a specific context, which is the treatment of a captive. Okay, I told you I was going to try to go quickly. That was famous last words. Let's move, try to go quickly over the next two sections, and then I'll see if you have comments. Verses 15 through 17 have to do with the status of the firstborn. Okay, so this is a law. Even saying it as a law is not perhaps the best description of it. This is a practice that you can see elsewhere in the Old Testament. Probably Isaac's treatment of Esau and Jacob is the most familiar thing, where they were contending for the birthright. So typically the firstborn would get two shares compared to the one share given to the other sons. It was all sons then. And that's the question here. Suppose a man had two wives. And again, I understand that of polygamy, although it's possible that they were not both alive. But you're in the sad condition, so speaking of Jacob, where one wife is loved and the other wife is not loved. And the case that's put forth is that the wife who is not loved is the mother of the firstborn. Does the father have the right to be partial, to show partiality, and instead give the firstborn status to the son of the wife he loves? Is that clear? Did I say that right? Okay. So can he shift the privilege from the son of the wife he doesn't love? Actually, in the original, it's he hates, but there's clearly a preference between the two that's shown here, to the one that he does love, to the son of the one he does love. And the answer is no, he is not allowed to do that. He is only to follow the standard procedure. And again, it's a limitation on the husband's authority. And maybe to understand how this would work out in practice and the implications it would have for us, we should realize that part of the point of giving two shares to the firstborn is that the firstborn had extra responsibilities. Okay, the firstborn was supposed to care for the parents when they aged. The firstborn was supposed to help out his younger brothers and sisters when they got in trouble. There are various responsibilities that were put on him. And so it only made sense to give him the extra resources so that he could carry out those responsibilities. Okay? So it's something that in our culture, especially when in some cases parents are sort of abandoned as they get older, you know, we may not relate to it as well. But it had a practical implication. It was a matter of honor. He is the beginning of his strength, as it says in verse 17. But there are also responsibilities that went with it. And so the provision that's made here is to underline the fact that the father can't be arbitrary. He's bound by God's law, just as he, as one in authority, is to work out God's law. And 1 Timothy 5:8 is applicable here. You know, if a man won't care for his own household, he's worse than an infidel. And that's really the point that's being made here, that the man has responsibilities. He can't just, on a whim, completely change the allocation of wealth. He has to act according to God's law. Let me make just a comment that the custom certainly did provide that the firstborn could be changed in case of moral turpitude, I guess is the phrase. So Reuben, for example, lost many of the privileges of the firstborn because of the way he acted immorally, sexual sin. So this law doesn't prevent that, but this law has to do with a sort of an arbitrary preference for one over the other that's not to be tolerated. Okay. Then the next case. The case of the stubborn and rebellious son. Okay. Now, so we're meeting in an elementary school. Okay, so is this saying that, you know, the case that's given here is that if the son is rebellious, if the parents really reach the end of the rope, as it were, then they can take the son to the elders of the city and he can be punished by the civil magistrate up to the limit of execution, the ultimate punishment that they could administer. Okay, so, you know, is this talking about little 5-year-old Johnny who refuses to eat his beans at dinner? Well, no, okay, it's not talking about children. It could be, in fact, the son is an adult. He's at least a juvenile delinquent, however you want to put it. I mean, he's a gluttonous and a drunkard, and that sounds more like an older child than a younger child. Okay, so I don't know if anyone's ever wondered about this point, but it's clearly a case of a pattern of stubbornness and rebellion. That's emphasized in the description here. The specific case of being a glutton and a drunkard points forward to his being a burden to society, we might say. He's not being a productive member of society. But the passage especially emphasizes the parents' efforts. So the voice of the father and the voice of the mother, both parents have been involved in trying to raise this child. They've chastened him. He won't listen to them. He's stubborn. He's rebellious. Verse 20, he's stubborn. He's rebellious. So you get the idea that this is a chronic case of rebellion. And the parents, as a last resort, then can turn to the civil magistrate, and the civil magistrate can act according to his authority. Now, that provision by itself would give a disincentive to be a juvenile delinquent, right? So you know that if you keep acting this way, that old mom and dad can stand in court and bear witness of what you've done. In terms of the civil order, though, this has to do with a point we saw when we looked at the fifth commandment. That is that both the parents and the civil magistrates, in a sense, stand in the place of God. They exercise authority on behalf of God. And so, from the point of view of the civil rulers, this person is a threat to society. He's not just a pain. He's not just wasting his life sitting around drinking and eating. But his attitude toward authority, which is serious enough in regard to his parents, is a threat to the whole society and is a breaking of the covenant bond for that reason. I put up on the board some other references to laws, Exodus 21, 15, and 17. Specifically, if a man struck his parents, that was a crime punishable by death. There are other references like that in the in the law, and also, I guess those are all in the law, similar references in Proverbs as well. So it's not, this is apparently not exactly that situation, but the ultimate penalty of execution is still there. Okay. Any comments or questions on those middle sections? Dan?
I just was kind of amused thinking about the way that they would give an extreme example, like you said.
Right.
And even God's law might do that. Just thinking of the Sadducees coming to Jesus and saying, let's say there was a woman who married, there were seven brothers.
Yeah.
And I have no, there's nothing to learn from this other than you can see they'll even take that same pattern.
Right.
And try to twist it and catch him. There are other examples too, trying to twist Jesus,
right.
Get Jesus caught in them.
And his answer was, have you not read?
Right.
Very simple way of cutting through all the smoke. Yep. Other comments or questions? Okay. Well, I managed to leave some time. Let's look at the last section then, which is only a couple of verses long, but very significant for both our understanding of this discussion of the violation of the sixth commandment, and also for pointing forward to the work of Christ. So, this, you might say, naturally flows from what we have just seen, because one outcome of having the parents bring the son, the only one that's mentioned actually, is that the son would be stoned to death. Okay, a grim prospect. And then verse 22, it says, if a man has committed a sin deserving of death, so what is to happen? Well, a common practice in that time was that the person's body would be displayed. The corpse would be displayed. So it says in verse 22, and you hang him on a tree. Not that it matters particularly for you, but this is probably hanging the corpse on the tree. The hanging wasn't the method of execution. Probably it was by stoning or some other method. But the hanging him on a tree was a way of displaying to the public that this person had been executed, that justice had been served, and that it was to serve as a warning to others. We've seen that sort of thing elsewhere in the book. So this is regulating that situation. Suppose we're in the situation that a person has been executed and the body has been put on the tree. What's the regulation given? The regulation is in verse 23 that his body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day. And the reason is an interesting one because, as I said, it ties back to the beginning of the chapter. You shall not defile the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Remember verse 1. It also ties back to the whole circle of ideas that we've seen in the last two chapters, and that is the sense in which the death of a man is a serious thing in the sight of God. Here, even a death which is justified. It's a serious thing that this corpse should remain on the tree, and so that shouldn't happen for more than a day. Now, this is not a pleasant subject to think about. That happens often in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy deals with real life and lots of questions we might not want to think about. But it's a very worthwhile for our understanding of God's law as well as understanding the work of Christ. So, first of all, I'll just point out that this idea of leaving people hanging on a tree is something that you're familiar with from other parts of the Old Testament. So, Joshua 8 and Joshua 10, when certain kings were conquered, their bodies were displayed in the same way. And actually, it says there carefully, their bodies were taken down before sunset. Looking forward a little bit into the New Testament, this is probably the reason why there was such care taken by the Jews for Jesus' body to be taken down from the cross before sunset. We've noticed that in many cases, the laws we're reading about were not actually followed by the Jews later on. This is one law that was carefully observed, and they understood the cross on which the Romans executed criminals as being a kind of a tree, and therefore the bodies were to be removed. They weren't to be displayed that way. So, this is something that the Jews understood, and that applied to them and was to be instructive for them in terms of who they were as people made in God's image. I thought I would read what Calvin says about this in his commentary. The object of this precept was to banish inhumanity and barbarism from the chosen people, and also to impress upon them horror of even a just execution. And surely the body of a man suspended on a cross is a sad and hideous spectacle. For the rites of burial are ordained for man, both as a pledge and symbol of the resurrection, and also to spare the eyes of the living, lest they should be defiled by the sight of so horrible a thing. The passage particularly, though, points to the defiling of the land, as I've already noticed, and gives us the explanation, for he who is hanged is accursed of God. What that would mean is that the person who walked by and saw this executed criminal would say, what a terrible thing the execution of God's law is, that it would fall on someone. That person is under the curse. What a terrible thing the curse of God is. It would be, for the person who walked by and saw the body, a visible display of the wrath of God and the anger of God against sin, and a reminder that God curses all sin. And that's the point of saying he who is hanged is accursed of God. God's law has been carried out on that person, and that person has been put to death. Now, in terms of the way the New Testament works it out, this out, it's a very striking thing. Probably in view of this passage, the New Testament frequently refers to the cross as a tree. You may have noticed that. Some translations aren't very helpful and retranslated as cross, but the word is actually tree. So I put up references in Acts there, Galatians, Lord willing, we'll turn to in a second, and also Peter in 1 Peter 2. And the reason is that the writers of the New Testament saw the crucifixion of Christ as being in some way, I should say it this way, that saw Deuteronomy 21:23 as being in some way helpful in terms of the way we think of the crucifixion of Christ. So let's turn to Acts chapter 5 and verse 30, just to see one illustration of this, and then so we have time, we'll turn to Galatians also. So here's Peter preaching, and he says in verse 30, sorry, jumping in the middle of the passage, but running low on time, the God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you murdered by hanging on a tree. So here, Peter, in a sense, acknowledges that they, by their actions, wished to treat Christ as a cursed one because they hung him on a tree. No doubt the Jews who saw Jesus at his crucifixion would have said, yes, that man is under a curse, because he broke God's law, he blasphemed God, and he deserves to hang on a tree. But what Peter goes on to say is very significant. He says, him God has exalted to his right hand, to be prince and savior, to give repentance to Israel and forgiveness of sins. In effect, saying that by the resurrection and ascension of Christ, he has shown that the curse has been broken, that Christ bore the curse for us, and that the wrath of the Father has been satisfied, and for that reason he has been exalted. And so the curse of the that's mentioned in Deuteronomy 23, the curse of the one who is hanged on a tree, became for the writers of the New Testament a thing to glory in, because it was Christ bearing the curse. Yes, the Jews understood that when they saw him on the cross. Christ is bearing the curse. But what they didn't understand was that he was bearing the curse not for himself, but for his people. And that's the striking thing that is especially helpful in the New Testament usage of this passage. Let's turn to see that in Galatians 3. Started a little bit late. I'm going to go a little bit later than I usually do. Paul in Galatians 3 is speaking of the role of the law, and especially of the way some sought to abstract the law from the covenant, So they sought to be justified by the law. And Paul says, in effect, that the ones who seek to be justified by the law, as he says in verse 10, for as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. So no one can be justified by obedience to the law. Cursed is everyone who does not continue in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. And so he explains the curse that comes on the one who seeks to take the law out of its context of redemption and make it as a way of acceptance before God. And the clinching point of his argument is in verse 13 of Galatians 3. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. And what's his proof text? For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree, quoting from Deuteronomy 21. So what the Jews who saw Jesus crucified, who sought to see him hang on the tree so that men would think of him as cursed, what they failed to see is that he bore the curse not for himself, but for his people. And he, therefore, shows us that the way to salvation is not by vain attempts to keep the law, but by believing in the other, in Christ who perfectly obeyed the law. I want to close then just to reflect, as we should often do when we study Deuteronomy. Okay, here's where I'm going a little bit longer, but we read Deuteronomy, if we read it in context properly, we understand that this is addressed to people who are redeemed by God, and they're learning how to live as those who belong to God. They're learning how to live, how to obey the sixth commandment, how to love their neighbor as themselves. But the temptation is always, as you read this week by week, and it's actually one of the functions of the law, is to sort of clobber you and say, you know, I don't love my neighbor as myself. And that curse that we read about in Deuteronomy 21 could well fall on me because I'm not a keeper of the law. And that's why God mercifully puts in again and again in Deuteronomy foreshadowings of the Savior to come, so that it points us to another who does perfectly keep the law and who becomes the curse for us, and who ultimately will not only bear the curse for his people, but will cleanse the land in terms of making a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwelled, so that the effect of Christ's work is seen in a grand and glorious way. Many people have pointed out that Jesus, in giving the story of the prodigal son, probably was drawing from Deuteronomy 21, in the way the son sought to give his inheritance, so maybe reflecting on the passage with the firstborn, and also the way that prodigal son was rebellious and went his own way stubbornly. But Jesus adds that note of grace that the father received the son, and in fact went out to seek him on the way. And so the book of Deuteronomy again and again drives us out of ourselves and points us to Christ and his glory. I had a really nice quote from Calvin's sermons, but maybe I better stop there. So, unless someone asks me to read it. Any comments or questions on Deuteronomy 21? Sam? Oh, thank you. You guys are so helpful. So Calvin asks the question, is it below the dignity of Christ that he should hang on the tree and be accursed before God? So he gives this beautiful answer. Surely so far was it from diminishing or defacing of Christ's glory that it is rather the chief thing whereby we are to magnify him. For we ought to be even ravished at the inestimable love of God towards us, and that he gave that his Son, who is the head of the angels, before whom all knees ought to bow, and unto whom all creatures ought to do homage, should so humble himself even to the lowest depths and bear our curse. When we see that our Lord Jesus Christ hath so forgotten himself and had so little regard of himself, that for very fervent love which he bare unto us, he took upon him the curse wherewith we were all overwhelmed, receiving it wholly to himself, is there any heart so hard which not to cleave at the sight thereof? Again, how ought we to be inflamed to glorify our Savior, who hath abased himself so far to save us? Thanks for asking. Great quote. Any comments? Any other comments or questions? Let's close in prayer.